This is a CBC podcast.
Gotta know who's jamming in Studio Q? Want to download a rockin' new Radio 3 podcast? Care to dissect the daily news on a blog by George Strombolopoulos? Find out how online at cbc.ca/entertainment.
One. This is your life.
Two.
This is your digital life.
Three.
This is Spark. cbc.ca/spark.
Hey, see those two cuties over there? The one in blue and the other in green? They're interested in you. I can tell just by the way they move. Hi, I'm Nora Young, and on Spark this time, from reading secret social cues to the latest way to get a date, we're all about communicating and feeling that spark.
Trying to get a big plate of...
How do you choose a date? Whose company would you enjoy? What about Anne? Anne would be fun on a date.
You scared to make a date, George?
I never asked a girl to anything.
Maybe you haven't, but you'd be wanting to someday.
But just how should he ask her? And what if she refused? No, it won't be easy asking for that first date.
No, it won't be easy. But what if you could avoid some of that dreaded first date tension? How? Well, Twana Hines has a few ideas.
My name is Twana Hines, and I have a blog at funkybrownchick.com. If it has to do with sex, dating, relationships, I'm all about it. I love it.
And one of the new spins on sex, dating, and relationships is called group dating, and it's an attempt to solve the age-old problem of the awkward date.
Well, actually, the idea started in Japan. I believe those were some of the first group dating sites and social circles that you see. And there, they're called kampa, short for companion, actually. Mm-hmm. And so you put together a group of friends, and then your group meets another group. So it's group-to-group dating, and you all go out. So say you and five friends all sign up for a group. One of the sites that a lot of people use is igniter.com. Mm-hmm. And the idea came from the sense that dating can be a kind of scary, so to speak. And so if you meet with other people, it's not that one-on-one dynamic that what if you've signed up for dinner with someone and you don't necessarily like them. So you're with other people. So if you don't mix with one, perhaps you mix with someone else, or maybe you come away with a friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that whole discussion of the awkward conversation over dinner was making the hair on the back of my neck stand up, actually.
Yeah, because we've all been through that. Mm-hmm. And there's no really social acceptance for midway through dinner saying, you know what, this isn't working for me. I'm going to get up and go. So you're just kind of stuck there.
Yeah. It seems to me like online dating is splitting into niches now. You know, you take group dating sites, or you've got sites for people with specific interests, like the environment. What have you noticed about this trend?
Yeah, I would say that's 100% true. I've noticed it as well. It used to be such that before, say, online dating sites as we know them now with lovealife.com or match.com, that was a great way to meet people. But as these sites got bigger and ballooned, you've got hundreds of people who may or may not be good matches for you.
Right.
And so you put in like someone aged 25 to 38 and pick and pluck what you think would be good. And then next thing you know, you've got all these different matches.
Mm-hmm.
So these niche markets really offer an opportunity to seek out someone you're looking for who may share specific interests, like greenfriends.com is for people who are very interested in the environment. And so it can also be like political interest, or deafdates.com for deaf and the hard of hearing. Even if you are HIV positive or have herpes or what have you, finding someone who's got some type of match with
mm-hmm.
you.
You can see in the case of something like HIV or herpes, how that would just solve so many sort of social awkwardness problems around the whole disclosure, you know, which is when do you have that conversation with somebody, whereas if you can have it before you even go into things, that makes things a lot easier. So where does this leave the big box dating sites, the Lava Lifes and the eHarmonies and Match.com and all those?
I think they're going to have to change, quite frankly, because there's so many other ways to do that now. You can meet people on Facebook, meetup.com, these group dating sites. And so they're really going to have to modify and adapt and change the way that they do business, because their old models aren't going to work in today's society.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a bit more about the, you know, the Facebooks and the social networking aspects? I mean, that's a perfect way to sort of connect with other people and to kind of advertise, if you will, yourself and your interests online. What kind of impact does that have?
Oh, it has a tremendous impact. I think people are integrating their social networks. So if you go to someone's site, like my blog, of course, I've got, hey, I'm on Twitter here. So it's twitter.com/funkybrownchick, or hey, I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm also on, you know, Facebook and here, such that you'll have a perhaps professional network via LinkedIn or something like that. And then that actually turns into someone who's a contact of yours. You become friends. Maybe you meet one of their friends. You start dating. So I feel like the way that we organize how we are as social beings online and on offline are coming together.
Mm-hmm. It's also free, which I guess is another advantage, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Thanks so much for talking to us, Tawana.
No problem at all. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's getting late.
Yes, it is. I'd ask you in for a bite to eat if it weren't so late.
I'll call you next week.
Will you? Thanks so much. I had loads of fun.
So did I. Night, Anne.
Okay, has this ever happened to you? Someone sends you a link to a web video and you click on it and you watch the first 30 seconds and then you realize that the whole video is 57 minutes long? Or maybe you've come across a blog post that you think is totally interesting, but it's way, way longer than you have time for.
Yeah, actually, Nora, that's called TLDR, too long, didn't read.
Right. This is Merlin Mann. He's the creator of 43folders.com, and he's doing a special series all about blogging and building an online presence that you can be proud of. And we want you to participate too. Up at the Spark blog, you'll find this whole series online, so you can listen again, you can follow along, or you can send it to a friend who blogs. That's at cbc.ca/spark. So Merlin, earlier in the series, we talked about finding your obsession and figuring out what you have to say. And the last time you were on the show, we talked about defining your audience and figuring out who you're actually trying to talk to when you make stuff online, right?
Yeah, exactly. We talked about very specifically who do you want to reach and really if there's one person in the world, who is it that you really want to delight?
Okay, so once we know who we're trying to reach, what next?
Well, this is a real pro tip. This is where we go to the next level. And I think one of the most overlooked aspects of having any kind of a blog, a sustainable blog that you can live with for more than a few months, and that's the idea of learning how to manage expectations. And managing expectations, this is one of those phrases people don't like because people tend to think that it means like you're being a jerk or you're pushing back. Managing expectations is just about setting a tone and setting a certain idea about some basics of what people can expect from your blog and what you can expect from them. And I think the troublesome thing about expectations that most of us eventually learn is that they get set whether we meant to or not.
So what are the kinds of expectations that we want to actually set up?
We're talking about things like how often will you be posting?
Right.
When you do post, what can people expect? Is it going to be a list? Is it going to be a video? Is it photos? You know, if you start out very eclectic, it's okay to be eclectic. Mm-hmm. And then what level of interaction can people expect? Are people expected to leave comments? Is there a forum? You know, if any of that stuff changes too abruptly, it can be really disruptive in a way a lot of people really had never expected.
Can you give me an example of, I guess, what not to do? You know, how somebody might mismanage their readers' expectations?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's hard. I mean, in some ways, a lot of people, because they don't think about this, are very accustomed to the idea that they just kind of post whatever occurs to them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think about blogs that I like a lot. I think about Jason Kotke. Kotke.org. He's got a very popular site. He's a great curator of links. He thinks a lot about culture and technology and how these things fit together. You know, and if Jason one day suddenly decided to post, I don't know, let's say 50 lolcats in a row, you know, I mean, everybody loves a lolcat. It's really funny. But, you know, it doesn't really fit the expectations. It kind of breaks the frame that Jason has worked so hard to create. And you kind of can't help but feel there's a little bit of incongruity to that.
Mm-hmm. So what else should we be thinking about when we talk about managing people's expectations online?
You always have to remember it goes both ways, which means that you have to learn what you're going to expect of other people. And if there's anything that we learn about blogs and email and all of this stuff, we learn that just because we think the world is one way doesn't mean everybody else does or should think it's the same way.
Yeah. Now, Merlin, I know that you love to give homework so people can think about this stuff and how it relates to them. Last week, he was thinking very specifically about your audience, choosing the 10 people and even the one person that you wanted to reach. What do you have for us this time?
Well, I think this one's a little bit easier. I mean, I think with all of this stuff, you know, we talk about ways to improve ourselves, but really we can start by thinking about things we're already familiar with. So, for example, we all have blogs that we love. We have community sites that we love. And I think it's important to ask yourself, if there's something that you've enjoyed for 1, 2, 3, 10 years, if there's something you've been following, ask yourself, You know, what is it that you kind of hope never changes about that blog or about that community site, right? There's something about it where if something really drastically changed, it would feel like a whole different experience. And I think that can be very telling. And really, by the same token, ask yourself, what do you kind of wish would change about a blog or a community site that you love? I think that's really, really instructive. And then the kind of the deeper homework, you can, I don't know if you're going to be able to do this in a week, but the best thing you can do with this is to say, knowing what I know about myself and about the things that I care about, how can I take these expectations and turn that really into what the blog's made of? Is there a series I could do? Is there some kind of an arc that I can introduce? And if there's something that I always want to be the same way for the life of my blog, how do I turn that into kind of an important part of my personal brand, if you like? What is it that I've really got to say?
It sounds like a great way to stay motivated about continuing to write the blog as well.
It's really easy to start a blog, Nora. It's really hard to keep finding not even something new to say. It doesn't really matter if what you have to say is new. What matters is whether it's what you really think and what you really care about. And finding a way to stay focused on that is going to be great for everybody.
Merlin, my favorite word in the Japanese language is ishikoro, which means pebble, and it's the word they use for abandoned blogs. Don't let your blog be abandoned like a pebble on a lonely beach, Merlin. Thanks a lot.
That's great. That's a good one. Thank you for the pebble, Nora. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Merlin Mann is the creator of 43folders.com. Now, we're halfway through this series about building an online presence you can be proud of, but it's not too late to get on board. We've posted all of Merlin's pieces at our show blog, so if you or someone you love have a digital footprint, why not follow along at cbc.ca/spark? Do the homework and get your zeros and ones all dookied up, like Mari, who left a comment at the Spark blog.
I'm following up on Merlin Mann's podcast the other week there. I agree wholeheartedly with Merlin. Obsession was the word he used, and it's a great word to use. If someone isn't passionate about their topic, then their blog is doomed from the start. This is especially true for corporate bloggers, since an abandoned blog by a company not committed or passionate about the reasons for blogging can be very damaging. Thanks again, and take care.
If you're following along with Merlin, get in touch with us like Mari did. Let us know how it's going. For the last segment, Merlin will be taking your questions about how to create the best work you can online. So get some free advice from an expert. When you get to cbc.ca/spark, just look for the post about Merlin and leave your comment or your question. And speaking of questions, I know someone who has one, and he's just outside the store.
Nora, how am I supposed to use my iPhone when I am wearing these mittens?
This is Dan Meisner. He works on Spark. Now, Dan, calm down. What are you talking about?
Okay, Nora, it's starting to get cold outside. Can you feel it?
Yes.
I've got my scarf here. I've got my mittens. I'm getting geared up for winter.
Yeah, me too.
But you know, Nora, this winter is very different than every other winter that has come before it.
How so?
Well, this is the first winter in Canada after the release of the iPhone, right? The wildly popular iPhone. Have you heard of it?
No. Yes, I think I remember something about it coming out in July, yes.
Right, well, and the iPhone just happens to be sort of the most famous example of these kinds of devices, but there are lots of them. Touchscreen devices where instead of, you know, pressing on actual physical buttons, the whole screen becomes touch-sensitive. Mm-hmm. And they're really, really popular. According to early numbers from Rogers, there are tens of thousands of just the iPhone in Canada. But I want to show you the problem, Nora.
Okay.
I've got my iPhone here. I want you to take it.
All right.
And I want you to try and dial a number while you're wearing your gloves.
Okay. Not working.
Okay, we'll just try to unlock it like you're answering a call.
Again, not working.
Okay, do you want to know why it doesn't work?
Sure.
Because I happen to know someone who can help explain. First, you have to take off your gloves so that you can actually touch the phone.
All right.
Okay, now go to contacts.
Yeah.
And then Professor Duncan Elliott.
Okay.
He's with the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Alberta. Put him on speakerphone.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi, Professor Elliott. I'm here with Nora Young.
Hi, Professor Elliott.
Hello, Nora.
Now, can you explain why Nora had to take her gloves off to use the touchscreen to call you?
Okay. Your iPhone has a capacitive sensor to detect where your finger is pointing and whether your finger is making contact. You can't see them, but there's conductors behind the touch screen. And if your finger is not close enough, there's not enough capacitance for the iPhone to sense. So with mittens on, your conductive finger is too far away.
Okay, so it relies on your body's conductivity to work, right?
Exactly.
Thanks very much, Professor Elliott.
Have a good day.
Okay, now, Nora, when we talk about using a touchscreen device when we're wearing gloves or mittens, mm-hmm. we're really talking about two things here, two problems.
Okay.
The first one has to do with that particular type of touchscreen device, the capacitive touchscreen, where the device just can't tell that your finger is there because you're wearing a glove.
Right.
And that affects not just iPhones, but all sorts of devices that use this same technology.
Mm-hmm. And as we said, there are lots of them.
Right, but the other problem actually has nothing at all to do with touchscreens. It just has to do with the fact that when you're wearing gloves or mittens, you lack a certain manual dexterity, right, because you're bundled up.
Right, and we all have tons of these mobile devices now, so
right.
problem.
Now, over the last little while, several companies have actually created products specifically to address these kinds of problems. For example, a company called Dots Gloves sells like these little mini gloves with small conductive metal dots on the fingertips. Another company called Free Hands sells convertible gloves where the thumb and the index fingers have flaps that fold back so you can have that direct skin-on-screen contact with your mobile device. And I actually wrote about this on the Spark blog.
cbc.ca/spark.
Yeah, and we got some really great suggestions. Derek Carpo suggests getting a stylus that's specifically designed to work with touchscreens. Jackie suggests knitting your very own pair of convertible uh-huh. mittens. Jack Chapman wrote in, he said, we don't have this problem in Australia, and he suggested that Canadians perhaps fly south for the winter.
Ooh, I like that.
But my favorite idea came from Sean T. on Twitter. And he says that if you can't answer your phone with your gloved finger, you should just use your nose to dial.
Just be sure you blow your nose first. That's all I can say. Well, what do you think? How do you keep your hands warm and use your touchscreen or mobile device at the same time? Share your tips at the Spark blog. Once again, that is cbc.ca/spark. Thanks, Dan.
Can we go inside?
You're the one who dragged me out here, man. Let's go.
Message 9, new, from an external number. Received today.
Hi, this is Daryl Cognito.
Valerie Hunter.
This is Jennifer.
Hi, this is Catherine.
Mike Vardy.
A few weeks ago, I was feeling so depressed. I was listening to Spark, but I couldn't help but feel like something was missing.
Something like a toll-free number.
Then I heard about 1-877-34-SPARK.
So I called. And it was so fun.
And so easy.
Now I call 1-877-34-SPARK every day.
Every day.
Sometimes twice a day.
Sometimes 40 times a day.
I've lost 30 pounds and inches off my waist.
My teeth are whiter.
And that rash on my shoulder cleared up. Thanks, 1-877-34-SPARK.
Thanks, 1-877-34-SPARK.
It's 1-877-34-SPARK.
Thanks. Love your show.
Okay, so on this episode of Spark, we've been talking about making contact and connections. Now, there are lots of ways to do that online, of course, but what about face-to-face? Now, say you're sitting down to a poker game, and not that online poker either, but the real look the guy in the eyes and watch the sweat break out on his upper lip poker. There's a pile of chips on the table. The woman to the left of you is cool as a cucumber, sitting perfectly still, gazing impassively at her cards. The man to the right of you is fidgeting a little, fiddling with his little pile of chips. Now quick, who has the better hand? You might be able to figure it out if you pay attention to honest signals.
Honest signals are our social sense. It's how we read each other.
That's Alex Sandy Pentland. He's a professor with MIT's Media Lab.
And I'm the author of a new book, Honest Signals, How They Shape Our World, published by MIT Press.
Sandy's been looking at how we can understand human behavior by measuring these honest signals. So in that imaginary poker game, the honest signals your fellow players give off might show
whether you're paying attention, if you're excited, if you are really know what you're doing, or whether you're a little uncertain. And in poker, they're actually called tells because they tell the other person. So there's a whole literature in poker about trying to suppress honest signals. But you can't really because they're really part of your biology. They're how we evolve to coordinate with each other. They're our social sense. They're how we read each other. And so what I've done is work out how those things work and build computer tools that can actually read them.
And what are these computer tools like? This is something called the sociometer, right? Can you describe it for me?
Oh, we have a little thing that we built into a name badge. So it looks just like a name badge, but it reads your tone of voice and how you gesture and who you're talking to. And then it turns out that those sorts of things, which communicate your social intent, are among the most important things in figuring out what you're going to do next. So an example is in salary negotiation. The way you carry yourself, the way you signal the other person, is as important as any other factor in determining what sort of salary you're going to negotiate. Or we went to bars and looked at speed dating, and it turns out the signals put off by the woman, the things that you're not very conscious of, but those are the things that predict whether or not people will trade phone numbers.
Hmm. You know, what I found particularly compelling in the book is the idea of group knowledge and this idea of a sort of network of intelligence that comes not from sort of just an individual rational decision maker, but from the behavior of people together. Can you flesh out how that works?
Mm-hmm. So what did we do before we had language? We still had ways to work as groups, to go hunt, to move, to find resources, and on and on and on. How did we trade the information that different people would have? How did we make group decisions? And it seems that the signaling is a mechanism for making really intelligent decisions that way. And you still see that when you see groups interacting. So, for instance, if you pay attention to people's immediate reaction when a new proposition comes out, mm-hmm. somebody says, why don't we do this? And if you look around the table, you see everybody reacting immediately. So do they get excited about it? Well, if they get excited about it, that says that there's something in it for them. And usually those immediate reactions are very important in determining how things are actually going to go in the group meeting. So if you pay attention to them the right way, you can actually read the group and make better decisions than if you could not paying attention to them. And there's a literature about this, of course, you know, how to win friends and influence people. I mean, it really is true, and it's folk knowledge, but, you know, we don't pay attention to it because we can't quantify it. And so I think the most significant thing about what I've done is now we can actually measure this human side of things that is so important for our performance, for our happiness, for our survival of our organizations and our culture.
Mm-hmm. You know, it strikes me that we think a lot about how new digital communications technologies can help us collaborate. You know, we talk about the power of crowdsourcing or wikis and so on. But your research suggests that there's a lot that we miss by not being physically in the same room with each other. What do you think that means for the way that we design or should design our communications technologies?
Well, it means that we evolved to be able to make these sort of crowdsourcing decisions through signaling behavior, and that works face-to-face and not over email.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really want to make better decisions, you have to have some mixture of face-to-face and email and other things. So, for instance, we did a study recently where we looked at an organization and what factors affected its productivity. So was it more information, the sort of thing you get from a wiki, or was it other things? And the thing that was by far the biggest factor was when you were just chatting with people, not as part of your job, around the water cooler, things like that, did everybody talk to each other? And if everybody talked to each other, you could be up to 30% more productive than if you were relatively isolated.
Hmm.
So it's not about wikis. It's not about email. It's about this other thing, this sort of face-to-face way where we integrate information. And the way I've come to understand it is that there's two phases in becoming a master of something and getting an organization. One is exploring, getting information. And email and web and things like that are very good for that.
Mm-hmm.
But the other is integrating, the sort of really getting your gut feel for it. And that takes actually sitting around and chatting with people, sort of chewing it over to really get it right. And that's the part that gets pushed off the table too often in organizations. And when it does, it's to their detriment.
Hmm. Sandy, we've been talking in this episode generally about our relationships and our use of technology. So just as an employee, when does it make sense for me to walk down the hall and talk to someone instead of sending them an email?
Well, walking down the hall and talking to people is good whenever you have complex information and whether you have to integrate it. So people have to understand it in their gut. we're very bad at those sorts of functions through email or wikis or things like that. Email and wiki is very good for facts, for figures, things like that. But to actually sort of get a feel for things, to reach an accommodation, an understanding, that's got to happen face-to-face.
Thanks so much for talking to us.
Okay.
You know, reading Sandy's book, I realized how often I communicate digitally rather than face-to-face. And I wrote about it on Twitter because I communicate digitally rather than face-to-face, and I got this response back from Wayne McPhail in Hamilton. A couple of weeks ago, I started using Twinkle on my iPhone. It's a Twitter application that lets you see who in your neighborhood is also on Twitter. I noticed a guy who was just a few hundred meters from me in downtown Hamilton. I followed him on Twitter and enjoyed his postings. So instead of firing him off an email, I suggested we meet at a local Tim Hortons for coffee last night. We did, and chatted for over 2 hours about Apple, iPhones, and social work. One of the most pleasant chats I've had in a long time. Twitter rocks, email rocks, but sometimes FaceTime trumps all. Thanks, Wayne. Now, Merlin already gave us some homework for this week, but you know what? I'm going to add another assignment. Talk to someone today instead of sending them an email, and I will do the same, even talkophobe me. Promise. And that's it for Spark this time. Spark was made by Dan Meisner, Elizabeth Bowie, and me, Nora Young, and by
Twana Hines,
Merlin Mann,
Duncan Elliott,
Alex Penplan,
and from the Spark community, Wayne McPhail,
Daryl Cognito in Calgary,
Derek Carpo,
Valerie Hunter,
Jackie,
Jennifer, Catherine,
Jack Chapman,
Mike Vardy,
and Mari. Spark was made with Creative Commons music and effects. Find the artists and links at the blog. And that's also where you'll find all the good stuff we're working on for our next show. So right now you can learn why a Canadian may be about to make an amazing breakthrough in water saving, and why saving just a little bit of energy makes a big difference if you do it a billion times. Plus, we're looking for your point of view on whether the paper phone book is becoming obsolete. It's all at the Spark blog, cbc.ca/spark. Or, hey, drop me an email, why don't you? Let me know what you think of this episode, spark@cbc.ca. Or try out our new phone number, toll-free in Canada, 1-877-34-SPARK, 1-877-34-SPARK. Reach out and get connected. I'm Nora Young, sending out Honest Signals. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.